Picture this, right? You've got this highly dialed in hobby printer sitting right on your desk.
Yeah, the pride and joy.
Exactly. It's printing beautifully. And you post a picture of a mechanical part online, and suddenly, boom, a business wants a massive order.
Oh, the dream.
Right? It's the moment. So you think to yourself, okay, this is it. You go out, you buy three more machines, you set them up on like a folding table in the spare room.
Oh no, a fold-out table.
Yeah, we've all been there. And you go to sleep dreaming of this very profitable little side hustle.
Right.
But then you wake up the next morning expecting four perfectly finished parts. And instead, you find a cascade of plastic spaghetti, a totally clogged hose end that's just encased in hard plastic, and a trip circuit breaker that took out half the room.
It's a brutal wake-up call because you tried to scale the hardware by just throwing money at more machines,
Yeah.
but you completely failed to scale the actual system running them.
Exactly. And we see this exact story play out all the time in the maker community. So our mission for this deep dive today is to really look at two comprehensive sources on, well, scaling a 3D print farm and printer maintenance.
Yeah.
We're pulling from this Monday Hub article about running 3 to 10 printers without just absolute chaos.
Good luck with that, right?
Right. And then we have a Thursday support article that's focused purely on advanced maintenance.
Okay.
Because the goal here is to figure out how you actually make that jump from a single hobby machine to a profitable fleet, without losing your mind.
Yeah, because that jump, it's a massive psychological hurdle. The sources really point out that once you pass a single printer, maintenance completely stops being this fun weekend ritual where you just sort of tinker with belts and screws for fun.
Right. It's not a hobby anymore.
Exactly. It becomes a strict economic necessity
Yeah.
because a print farm actually starts the exact moment you stop thinking about individual machines and you start thinking entirely about job queues and overall throughput.
Because if you're, hovering over three machines, babying them through their first layer, you aren't really running a farm.
No, not at all.
You're just stressing yourself out three times as fast.
Yeah.
The bottleneck is no longer the machine's speed. It's your attention span.
Right, human bandwidth.
Yeah. So to manage that throughput effectively, you first have to decide exactly what kind of machines will, make up your fleet. And the scale of this problem gets pretty intense. The Hub article brings up this amazing statistic about Prusa Research.
Oh yeah, the farm.
Yeah, they organically grew their own internal print farm from six printers all the way to 600.
Which is just wild to think about.
It's crazy, and they still use that massive farm to manufacture the plastic parts for the very printers they sell to the public.
Which is, I mean, that's a logistical marvel, but managing that volume, it comes down to a very specific decision framework for, buying your next few machines.
Right.
And the first major choice you face is the classic debate of homogeneous fleet versus a mixed fleet.
Let's actually build that decision guide right now for the person listening who is about to buy machines 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, yeah.
Because my instinct as a maker, I want to buy one of everything.
Of course you do.
I do. I want a resin printer for tiny details,
Yeah.
and then like a large format machine for helmets. And, a fast Core XY machine for standard parts.
Oh, I totally get the temptation. A mixed fleet, it gives you supreme flexibility across different material types and job kinds.
Yeah.
But the sources are very clear on the hidden costs here. If you go that route, you have to absorb the heavy cost in time and money of managing separate calibrations,
Right.
different slicer software profiles, unique firmware updates for each distinct model. I mean, every time you switch machines, you context switching in your brain.
Yeah, and that takes time. So the alternative is the homogeneous fleet,
Right.
buying, say, 10 identical machines. I
Exact.
suppose that means you only need one print profile
Yep.
and like one single drawer of spare part
One drawer.
and one repeatable maintenance procedure.
And that standardization is where the real profit hides.
Okay.
If you want to see standardization done right, look at the University of Calgary Makerspace case study from the sources.
Oh, yeah, that was impressive.
Yeah, since 2017, they have run more than 70 MK4 printers and four of the larger Excel machines,
Wow.
and they serve over 3,000 students a year.
That's a lot of files.
It's a ridiculous amount of files, and you simply cannot maintain uptime for 3,000 students throwing wildly different files at you if every machine on the rack requires a different troubleshooting manual.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When a thermistor breaks, the staff knows exactly which drawer the spare is in and exactly how many screws it takes to replace it.
I see how that saves hours of labor. But if you lock yourself into one machine type, aren't you also locking yourself into specific materials?
Yes.
Like the hardware you choose kind of dictates what you can actually offer your clients.
Absolutely. Your clients' needs have to dictate your hardware from day one. Let's look at the Bamboo Lab ecosystem as an example.
Yeah.
The A1 line suits PLA and PTG plastics perfectly.
Because they're open frame, right?
Exactly. They're open frame printers, so they get plenty of cooling, which those materials love.
Right.
However, if your clients need technical engineering grade materials like ABS or ASA, the A1 is just the wrong tool.
Right, because ABS is notorious for warping.
Oh, yeah.
Like, as it cools, the plastic shrinks rapidly.
Yeah.
And it will literally pull itself right off the build plate and curl up into a potato chip.
It's the worst, which is why you have to choose enclosed machines for those materials.
Okay.
Things like the P1S or the X1C. You need that physical enclosure to, you know, trap the heat, control the thermal environment so the plastic cools slowly.
Uh-huh.
And handle the extraction of nasty fumes.
Oh, true. Okay, yeah. So let's say you pick your standard machine, right? You buy four of them, and you line them up on a sturdy bench.
Beautiful.
Now you have a totally new bottleneck.
SD cards.
Feeding them SD cards manually. Yes.
Yeah.
It's you have to physically walk to each machine, click through a tiny screen menu, and just pray you loaded the right G-code file.
Yeah, the SD card shuffle is miserable.
It is. So you obviously need software to manage the farm.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people, you know, they push back here and say, is scaling software really that hard?
Wow.
Isn't it just like opening a few more browser tabs on your computer?
Yeah, no. The browser tab analogy is a trap.
Okay, why?
It falls apart incredibly quickly when you scale. So take Octoprint, which is fantastic for a single machine.
Right. I love Octoprint.
Everyone does. You hook up a Raspberry Pi microcomputer to your printer and you get wireless control, camera feeds. It's great.
Yeah.
But running five separate Raspberry Pis for five printers creates a massive administrative burden.
Because they're individual computers.
Exactly. You are now a network administrator. You're managing five separate IP addresses, five different video streams, and five underlying operating systems that all need security updates.
Oh, right. I didn't even think about the updates.
Yeah, plus the compute load on cheap hardware will absolutely choke when you start uploading large, complex G-code files while trying to stream HD video at the same time.
Oh, wow. So if I just refuse to become a systems administrator, what are my alternatives? Because, I want to spend my time printing, not updating Linux packages.
Fair enough. You have two main diverging paths for farm management. First, there's Clipper, paired with the mainsail interface.
Okay.
Clipper is a really fascinating approach because it fundamentally changes how the printer thinks.
How so?
It moves the heavy mathematical computation off the printer's tiny underpowered mainboard and onto a much more powerful host computer.
Let's pause on that. Why does a 3D printer need heavy math in the first place? Isn't it just following simple XYZ coordinates?
Well, it is following coordinates, but it's doing it at extreme speeds.
Okay.
When a print head is moving at 500 millimeters per second and it needs to round a sharp corner, the math required to calculate the exact acceleration, deceleration, and motor current is pretty intense.
I guess that makes sense.
Clipper handles that math on a faster processor and just sends the final electrical commands to the printer. This unlocks incredible performance features like input shaping.
Oh, input shaping. That's essentially like noise-canceling headphones for your printer, right?
That is a great way to describe it, actually.
Like, it measures the physical vibrations of the machine and injects counter movements to cancel out the shaking.
Exactly. It allows for flawless prints at high speeds.
Yeah.
Clipper also gives you centralized management for multiple machines, but the trade-off is a steep learning curve.
Okay.
You're going to be configuring raw text files, writing custom macros, and spending a lot of time tuning parameters.
I'm going to be honest. Tuning text files sounds like exactly what I am trying to avoid. What's the other path?
The other path is the closed ecosystem approach, largely popularized by Bamboo Lab.
Ah.
They use their own cloud network alongside local MQTT protocols to monitor machines straight out of the box.
Okay, MQTT, let's translate that for a second.
Right.
That's basically a lightweight local messaging system, right? It allows the printers to talk directly to your computer over your local network without having to bounce the signal to a server halfway across the country.
Correct. It is incredibly fast and very efficient. You just plug the printer in, open their desktop app, and you can instantly see all your printers in one unified queue.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, you can send a print to an entire fleet with just two clicks.
I have to admit, I heavily lean toward the plug-and-play nature of that bamboo setup.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds way less stressful than editing code just to get a motor to spin.
It is unquestionably easier to start, but this debate raises a really important question about ownership and control.
Because it's closed off.
Right. With a closed system, you're trading convenience for deep access. You sacrifice the granular firmware control that an open system like Clipper provides.
Mm.
If a highly unique problem pops up or you want to install a custom tool head, Clipper lets you, you know, pop the hood and rewrite the core logic. A closed system just blocks you out completely.
Yeah.
You're at the mercy of the manufacturer's update schedule.
Both systems seem to converge on one simple truth, though,
mm-hmm.
right? Whatever management system you pick, its only job is to reduce your daily overhead.
Yes.
If your software requires you to babysit it, it's failing.
Exactly. But here is the harsh reality the sources pivot to.
Okay.
Software can only do so much. A beautiful cloud dashboard can send you a push notification that a print failed. Or, you know, that a nozzle is cold.
Right.
But it cannot prevent the mechanical failures that actually ruin your profit margins. As your fleet works harder, your physical infrastructure and your physical maintenance routines become your only true safety net.
And this is where I think so many ambitious makers fail.
Oh, entirely.
They optimize their software queue, but they completely ignore the physical reality of machines just, you know, shaking themselves apart.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the physical space first,
mm-hmm.
because the infrastructure realities are unforgiving. Like, if you put 10 fast Core XY machines on a cheap wire rack from a big box hardware store.
Oh, that's a nightmare.
You are going to have a terrible time.
Yeah. Core XY is a motion system where two stationary motors work together using long belts to move the print head.
Right.
It allows for blistering speed, but that speed generates serious kinetic energy.
Yeah, I've seen tables literally rocking back and forth.
Exactly. 10 machines throwing their print heads around at the same time require heavily reinforced shelving. If the shelf sways even a little bit, those vibrations transfer right back into the prints.
Resulting in those ugly rippling marks on the surface, yeah. Right?
Ghosting.
Ghosting, exactly. It ruins the part.
Wow. And beyond mechanical stability, there's the electrical side. The sources call electrical load the silent killer in print farms.
People vastly underestimate how much power a heat in bed draws during its initial warm-up phase.
Really?
Yeah. Maintaining heat takes very little energy, but getting a large aluminum plate from room temperature to, say, 100 degrees Celsius, that pulls massive amps.
Wow. Okay.
If you have 10 machines and they all start a new job at the exact same time, the power spike is huge.
You can't just plug them all into a power strip. No. Spreading that electrical load across multiple dedicated household circuits is a hard requirement. You cannot just daisy chain sheet power strips and hope for the best.
Not to mention the fire risk,
yeah.
Right? Running heavy loads overnight means smoke detection and temperature monitoring directly above your server racks are basically non-negotiable.
Absolutely. It all comes down to minimizing risk, which brings us to the most counterintuitive piece of advice from the support article regarding actual maintenance.
What's that?
Manufacturers strongly advise checking and servicing key mechanical components every few hundred print hours, even on a machine that is running flawlessly.
See, I always struggled with this advice.
Yeah.
It feels incredibly wrong to touch a machine that's working well. Like if I have a dialed-in 3D printer churning out beautiful parts, taking a wrench to, it feels like I'm just inviting a disaster.
I get that.
It feels like taking a perfectly working car engine apart just to look at it.
Yeah, but the car engine analogy is where people get stuck. Think of it more like a concert pianist tuning a grand piano. If one string drifts slightly out of tune, the piano still plays music. A casual listener might not even notice.
Sure.
But if you're recording an album, or in this case, running a production line where tight tolerances matter, that slight drift ruins the final product.
I see.
Dry linear rods or slightly loose pulleys, they don't cause an immediate spectacular crash. They slowly degrade your dimensional accuracy. It's a slow, silent creep.
Right. So your perfectly round circles become slightly oval.
Exactly.
And your snap fit parts suddenly need to be like sanded down just to fit together.
Yep. And eventually the friction builds up enough that the stepper motor actually skips a step and you get an unexplainable layer shift halfway through a 30-hour print.
Oh, that's the worst feeling in the world.
It is. By doing preventative care, you reset that slow wear and tear. Scheduled downtime is always cheaper than reactive downtime.
Okay, let's get into the specific mechanics of that scheduled downtime then. Because the sources highlight a few critical maintenance rules that go beyond the basic beginner stuff. Let's start with belts. How do you actually know if a belt is too loose without just guessing?
Well, belts stretch naturally over time as they heat up and cool down. The standard procedure is the deflection test.
Deflection test.
Yeah. You move the print carriage all the way toward the motor side. Then you grab the belt at the exact midpoint of its longest span and press down with your finger.
Okay.
A properly tensioned belt should not deflect more than about 10 millimeters.
And mechanically, like, if it moves more than that 10 millimeters, the belt has too much slack.
Right.
And when the motor tries to reverse direction quickly, that slack causes a micro delay in the movement, which is what translates into those rippling coasting artifacts we talked about.
That is the exact mechanism. Now let's talk about the hotend.
This is a big one. Because I see people destroy their hardware all the time trying to change an nozzle.
Oh, it hurts to watch.
They grab a wrench, twist hard, and just snap the metal right off.
The absolute golden rule here is thermal expansion. You must always swap nozzles while they are hot.
Always.
When you print, molten plastic seeps into the microscopic gaps in the threads. When it cools down, it acts like industrial glue.
Right.
If you try to force a brass nozzle out of an aluminum heater block while it's cold, the plastic will hold so tight that you will shear the metal threads right off, destroying the entire assembly.
I've actually done that. It's not fun.
Most of us have. Mm. You have to heat it up to printing temperature, carefully hold the heater block with a wrench so you don't bend the heat break, and unscrew the nozzle.
Yeah. And the other highly misunderstood maintenance area is lubrication. Because a lot of people just grab whatever spray can they have sitting in the garage.
Oh, yeah. The warnings in the sources are severe regarding this. You absolutely must not use WD-40 spray on your linear rods or bearings.
Right, because it's not real grease.
Exactly.
Yeah.
WD-40 is primarily a solvent designed to displace water. It is not a lasting mechanical grease. If you spray it on a printer, it'll actually break down and wash away the good factory grease that is already packed inside the bearings.
Leaving you with dry metal. Grinding on dry metal.
Which is a disaster.
So you need a dedicated, proper viscosity synthetic grease.
Right.
But even then, you can't just smear grease everywhere, right?
No, no.
The sources point out specific machine rules. For example, Prusa strictly states in their documentation that you should not apply any lubricant to their Z-axis trapezoidal nuts or the vertical threaded lead screws.
Which confuses a lot of users.
Yeah, they see a threaded rod and just assume it needs oil.
But those specific trapezoidal nuts are made of POM, a specialized self-lubricating plastic. They're designed to run dry.
Okay.
If you apply grease to them, it acts like a magnet for dust and stray filaments. It gums up the threads, increases friction, and does significantly more harm than good.
Right. So read the manual for your specific machine.
Always.
This brings us to a major turning point, though. Because knowing the mechanics of belt deflection and proper grease is totally useless without a strict rhythm.
Yep.
We need to turn these maintenance theories into a concrete system. Because if you just tell yourself you'll lube the rods when you have some free time, you will never do it.
You never do. And to build a proper maintenance schedule, you need real data. You cannot just guess how long a printer has been running based on, like, how many spools of filament you bought.
Right. But thankfully, modern machines track this. On Prusa machines, the accumulated print hours appear right in the LCD menu under the statistics tab.
It functions exactly like an odometer for your car, really.
Yeah. And that data leads us directly to the most critical takeaway from our sources today.
Yes, it does.
So if you're scaling up and you take one actionable thing away from this deep dive, this is it. Log each printer's hours from the statistics menu and schedule a lubrication and belt tension check every few hundred hours.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, always perform a one-minute visual check before any long overnight job.
That 1 minute of focused attention, it pays for itself the very first time it catches a failure before it starts.
Let's visualize how this system actually looks in practice.
Okay.
So it's a Friday afternoon. You're about to kick off a massive batch of ABS parts for a client that will run all weekend.
High stakes.
Yeah. Before you send the files over the network, you physically walk down the line of machines. You spend exactly 1 minute per printer. You check the bed adhesion surface for oily fingerprints or dust, you know, wiping it with isopropyl alcohol.
Vital step.
You wipe the nozzle clean with a brass brush so stray plastic doesn't ruin the first layer. And most importantly, you physically check the filament spool to ensure it actually has enough weight left to finish the required job.
Oh, man, that last step is huge. Wow. So many weekend production runs fail simply because a spool ran out 3 hours before the end of a 40-hour print.
It's heartbreaking.
It really is. Implementing that one-minute checklist transforms a stressful weekend of hoping things work into a reliable, boring manufacturing process.
And boring is profitable.
Exactly.
So, tying this all back to the original mission, what does this all mean for the person trying to build a real business out of desktop manufacturing?
Well, the economic reality is pretty clear. The financial barrier to entry for print farms has plummeted.
Yeah.
You can buy incredible desktop machines today with features that cost 10 times as much 5 years ago. However, a farm only pays off based on your product margin, not your printer count.
That is a harsh truth. Having 10 printers doesn't make you a business if it takes you 10 times as long to manage them.
Right. If you just print whatever random files come your way without standardizing your fleet and without maintaining a disciplined, scheduled maintenance routine, your profits will simply vanish.
Just disappear into thin air.
They'll be entirely eaten up by failed parts, wasted material, and the endless manual labor of constantly fixing preventable issues. I mean, if a part costs $2 in plastic but takes 15 minutes of your manual labor to prep, clean, and fix, your margin is destroyed by labor costs.
It really puts the focus on human efficiency over machine speed.
Absolutely.
Which brings me to a final thought for everyone listening. We've talked about standardizing the hardware to limit variables. We've debated the software to streamline the file delivery. We've systematized the maintenance to prevent downtime.
Yeah, everything is dialed in.
Everything is dialed in. But as long as a human being has to physically walk over, flex a build plate, and pry every single finished part off the bed just to start the next job.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
Are we really running an automated print farm? Or have we just successfully created a very demanding assembly line job for ourselves?
Yeah. That physical part removal remains the true bottleneck of desktop manufacturing scaling.
Something to think about the next time you're scraping plastic off a bed at midnight on a Sunday. For the full numbers, see printarray3d.com.